This is New Beginnings, hosted by award-winning broadcaster and speaker Freddie Bell. A program for and about America's 78 million baby boomers. Here's your host, Freddie Bell.
Hi, everyone. This is New Beginnings. I am Freddie Bell. Glad you're with us today. And coming up on the show, many of our favorite partners, including Leibel Sternbach is here, Joe McKenzie, and friends from AARP Minnesota. All this plus the words to the wise on New Beginnings. And our program is underway right now. Hi again, everyone. We're combating elder financial abuse, and to help us with this is John Schwartz. He used to be an FBI agent, so you know he knows how to investigate. He has stood up a company called Center for Combating Elder Financial Abuse. John, hello and welcome back to our program.
Hey, Freddie. Thank you very much for having me.
We talked about what elder financial abuse. If you can just give us a 30-second, what is elder financial abuse?
Elder financial abuse is a predator crime in which a financial predator will target the most vulnerable and then use various attack vectors, such as Ponzi schemes, in order to take a portion or majority of a victim's life savings.
So how long does it take for someone who is this culprit out there to take money from an unsuspecting individual? How long before a loss has occurred?
Well, Freddie, in some instances, it's a blink of an eye, and that really is the case. There was a situation out in Nevada. There was a guardian by the name, a professional guardian by the name of April Parks, and one of her victims, Rennie North, described how he was victimized. He said there was a knock at the door one day. They came in and said, "We're officers of the court." They had a court order, and they took us away that morning. So it can happen in a blink of an eye.
Well, everybody, we're talking with John Schwartz about elder abuse and the impact of it. Talk about it. Some cases, you know, we talk about predators and abuse like this, and sometimes the victim is blamed. Is that the case with elder abuse, too? Does the victim ever get blamed?
Well, they do, Freddie, and that's a large component of elder financial abuse, just like any other predator case. When the victim says, "Hey, I've been victimized," at times the victim will be asked questions. Well, what did you? You simply made a bad financial decision, or, you know, we told you not to talk to this person, but you did it anyways. So they do get blamed. I don't look at elder financial abuse as a family. I don't dismiss it as a family matter, a civil matter, or a bad investment. I call it what it is. It was a predator that was grooming the most vulnerable. And once they were able to groom that person, they were able to gain control. So, yes, they do get blamed, or we should be blaming the predator themselves. And I want to stick on one more point with this. We absolutely cannot blame somebody who's been a victim of elder financial abuse. They've already been traumatized. So if their support group then turns the blame on them, it just furthers the traumatization that they've already experienced.
So what are some of the tactics that these predators use to gain the confidence of these unsuspecting individuals and ultimately wind up with millions of dollars?
What they do is they'll tap into any range of emotions. A couple of emotions that they'll tap into is these sweetheart schemes that is conducted either online or over a telephone, to where they tap into the emotion of love, which is very powerful for somebody who's lonely. So if the predator's done the research on this individual, and that's what they do, they'll find out that they're somewhat lonely, and they'll use that emotion of love. The other emotions they use is joy and thrill, like a sweepstakes scam. Hey, you won $1 million. You just need to pay the fees and taxes up front, and they'll do it. Then finally, fear. And that comes from the grandparent scheme, where the predator will call and say, "Hey, we have, you know, we found out that your grandson's been in a car wreck. your grandson's actually hit a pregnant lady, 7 months pregnant. We're the attorneys, but we need money now. And they'll put the time element on it, too. And then finally, going back to the thrill, Ponzi investment schemes work very well because they'll promise, hey, you know, I can give you 20% return on your investment. And then even if the market goes down, you know, you'll be safe from that. So these are the range of motions that they use in their grooming process.
So, John, in the few seconds we have left, what can we do today to protect ourselves? If we are the elder, what can families do to protect their family members?
Now, that's a fantastic question. So what I would say is conduct an assessment either on yourself if you're an elderly person or a loved one if you're a child or a sibling. But what I'll say to that is that's exactly what the predators do. They'll take a look at one elderly and realize, well, you know, this individual says, not lonely. They're still married. They're playing golf 3 times a week. They go to church. They have family members living close by. That's probably not a good target. But if you take another individual that's in their maybe mid to late 70s, there is no spouse. Kids don't seem to be close by. Now they seem somewhat isolated. That's who the predator targets, and they're successful at it.
Well, how can we get more information? How can we connect with you, John?
Thank you. So our website is endefa.org. I'll spell it. It's endefa.org. Again, endefa.org. I have a contact button on there. I'd love to hear from individuals, and we're here to serve.
All right. He's John Swartz, and this is New Beginnings.
And now, our supporting partner, AARP in the Twin Cities.
And joining us now, we turn our attention to Kathy McClear, AARP Minnesota State Director. And we want to save time, but we also like to save money. Kathy McClear, hello and welcome back. Let's talk about savings and planning.
Thanks, Freddie. This is such an important issue. And I can't stress enough that, you know, we really are facing kind of a retirement crisis, and a secure retirement, of whatever age you decide that's going to be, is all too often out of reach for so many people. We know that nearly half of Americans nearing retirement age, which I think typically we tend to think of 65 years and older. Of course, many people are working longer these days because they choose to, but many work longer because they have to. Nearly half of those Americans who are nearing retirement age have less than $25,000 put away, while one in four has less than $1,000 in savings.
Wow. So that makes it really difficult. Even, 65, we understand that your expenses start to go down, but even at that level, that's pretty difficult to live, isn't it?
Well, it is. And really, AARP, we want to make sure that your money lives as long as you do. And we know that while maybe your expenses go down, often, you know, once you hit age 65 and older, your healthcare expenses go up. And so it really is a matter of planning for your future, making sure you understand what needs you're going to have in retirement, and then, you know, making some decisions to help your money last long enough.
Social Security benefits are out there, but I've heard you say on this program that that's not nearly enough.
Yeah, in Minnesota, the average Social Security benefit check for folks 65 and older is just over $1,700 a month. And we know that close to half of retirees 65 and older rely on that Social Security income for at least half of their income. But, you know, Freddie, what I think is really challenging is there are many disparities when you look at that earned benefit that Social Security provides. So I said that average Social Security benefit is $1,700 a month. For women in Minnesota, it's $1,500 a month. And then when you talk about women of color, it is far less, receiving on average between $940 a month and $1,250 a month. And so while Social Security is very much a safety net, it was never intended to be a person's sole source of their income in retirement. And it's so important to have those personal savings, as well as taking advantage of any workplace retirement plans that you might have access to.
So what does AARP propose? What can help to bridge that gap and to increase the income, if that's possible, of your retirees and members?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple of kind of common sense things. And if you plan on working into retirement, making sure you're keeping those job skills up to date. Certainly managing your debt. If you go into retirement with a lot of debt, that's really going to hurt your prospects of having a secure financial future. Lots of folks don't know this. You can claim Social Security at age 62, but the longer you wait, if you wait until that full retirement age, so for me, it's about 67 and a half, but if you wait even until the age of 70, that's going to result in a larger monthly benefit, which can really have a significant impact on your financial security later in life. And then finally, if you are someone who is relying on that Social Security benefit for a majority of your income, it's really important to determine your eligibility for some of those public assistance programs. So things like maybe SNAP or the Medicare Savings Program or any types of property tax relief that might be available to you. So it's really important to stay informed and do your homework so you can really have a secure financial future.
It's a complex situation. Is there a place or a resource that we can go to get more information about Social Security and other programs that are really beneficial to your retirees and members?
Sure. You know, a great place to start is aarp.org, and then just put into the search anything that might be helpful. So whether it's Money Map that can help you pay down debt, or student loans, if you are someone who still has student loans, or work if you're looking for some of those job skills. So aarp.org is a great place to start.
Kathy, you always have great information for us, and we'll be right back with more on New Beginnings. And now from the lighter side, I'm Freddie Bell. Experts believe by 2030 there will be daily space tourism flights. I'm not going until they can fix a good margarita in a weightless environment. And here are some models to live by. Motivational or anti-motivational? Eagles may soar, but weasels aren't sucked into jet engines. No one is listening until you make a mistake. Here's another one. Success always occurs in private, and failure is in full view. Another model, the hardness of the butter is proportional to the softness of the bread, and you'll never really learn to swear until you learn to drive. It's wacky, but it's true. An Italian man who was arrested and charged for dumping construction waste was taken back to court after he was caught violating his house arrest. The man asked to be given a jail sentence instead to escape his wife's nonstop nagging at home, he says. However, the judge sent the man back home and ordered him to try to get along with his wife. We're drinking like there's not going to be a tomorrow. According to the National Center for Drug Abuse Statistics, 24% of people 18 and older reported binge drinking in the last 30 days. Binge drinking is a pattern of alcohol consumption that involves consuming large amounts of alcohol in a short period with the intention of becoming intoxicated. And did you realize that being a mom is the equivalent of 2.5 full-time jobs? Everyone knows that moms are heroes, as it's a job where you just can't clock out at 5 o'clock. Recent research confirmed what every mother knows. It's actually more than a full-time job. A survey of 2,000 American moms of children 5 to 12 analyzed their weekly work schedule. The study revealed that the average daily start time for a mom is 6:30 a.m. Once she's finished all the tasks, whether they are career-related or parenting, she ends her workday by 8:30 p.m. In total, that makes a mother's working week a whopping 98 hours of work, or 2.5 times, as I mentioned, more than the average job. And if you want to be happy in life, it has to come from within. Getting married just won't do it. At least that's the word from research that was published by the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. While newlyweds do tend to experience an initial boost of happiness, they eventually return to the same outlook they had on life before the wedding. Just for fun this week, I'm Freddie Bell.
You're listening to New Beginnings. New Beginnings with Freddie Bell.
Hi again, everybody. I'm Freddie Bell, and this is New Beginnings, Appointed Listening. So glad that you're with us. We have a lot of great things to cover with you this weekend, and joining us now is Mr. Joe McKenzie. He founded Ripple Connects. I don't recall. How many years ago has it been now, Joe McKenzie?
It's almost 10 years ago.
10 years ago, and you turn candidates into contenders. You can reach Joe McKenzie at 763-438-1621. Hello and welcome back, Mr. McKenzie.
Thank you, Freddie Bell. How are you today?
Unbelievable. And look, this is our time to delve into the book, Words of the Wise. Where are you taking us this week?
Well, as always, I take a page and I spend 3-4 days reflecting upon it. And it's been very helpful for me in my career. So thank you, Freddie. This daily affirmation turns into a project or just kind of that thought process for me to, okay, maybe I've got to, this week, trust your instincts, the knowing. Mm-hmm. And those are your words to the wise. And I often think about how I've made good career decisions and I've made not so good career decisions. When I think about it, Freddie, I've trusted my instincts more than I can count. But there are times where I leaped when I didn't give it as much thought and didn't feel like I knew enough. And that did result in sometimes not a great career move. But my instincts, I think I've developed them over the years, Freddie, for the type of culture, the type of people I want to work with, the type of mission I want to be a part of. Mm-hmm. And I've used that in my career to help me make good decisions. How have you utilized trusting your instincts in your career?
Well, it becomes a process, much like what you're talking about. We hear the word meditate. And when we think about meditating, I think for some, it brings up the vision of a Buddha, and you're sitting cross-legged with your hands pressed together, eyes tightly shut, and you're blocking out the world. That's a form of it. But I think the intuition has to be cultivated. Your instinct has to be cultivated. It's like, every spring, we were talking about spring last week when we got together, that at beginning of springtime, and I'm thinking about baseball, what do professional teams always do at the beginning of a season?
They train.
They train.
They hone their skills that they may have lost over the winter.
That's right. They go back to the basics. And that's a lot of what we should be doing or think about anyway with regard to developing our instinct. We go back to the basics. You mentioned meditating. So maybe we've developed the skill of meditating over time. Maybe we're new to it. But the idea is to hold that thought, whatever it is in your mind of a positive nature, toward the goal of whatever it is that you're seeking. And so in that way, it helps you to develop the instinct. Your mind is open. You're open and receptive to the ideas that come to you. And then it makes it easier for you to take a chance on following on your gut, that knowing. And I figured out over time, Joe, that the instinct, it doesn't necessarily just hit you once. You can define it pretty easily when that same thought keeps coming again and again and again, and it's so persistent that you begin to know that that this is the right path to take or the right person to contact or the right move to make, whether it's your career or just simply trying to get along in life.
Mm-hmm. So taking that time, and if that same thought keeps coming back, and you're keeping this in a positive light. You're looking at a new career move or an opportunity you want to seize, and you have that same thought that's reoccurring because you're allowing yourself time to meditate, to reflect, to let it, absorb. And that's what you learn about yourself from your previous career decisions using your instincts, right? That's kind of what I hear you saying.
Exactly.
That's the process you follow that's worked for you.
You've been through a lot of things over time. Some people are just getting out of college. There are people who are more seasoned. Mm-hmm. And we bring with us, no matter where we are, we bring with us our experiences. And in those experiences, we can find a lot of ways to run from something, a lot of reasons to avoid something. But the pathway toward a goal is a bit more narrow. And while you have all these signposts when you're trying to run that say, danger, 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 don't you do this, this could happen, there are fewer that tell us that we're on the right path. And because there are fewer, they become to be more repetitive. You hear those thoughts, those intuitions over and over and over again. The other thing I would say, you know, where this is springtime, I would say spend time outside, physically outside, whether it's 15 minutes, 10 minutes, but if you do it proactively with the idea of getting in touch with yourself, getting in touch with the universe, that is so valuable, Joe McKenzie.
Yeah, and that's taking a long walk, not, you know, being in front of a screen, just, you know, absorbing that vitamin D from the sun, seeing something that's put you in a relaxed state to help you with that positive thought process that you have going. You're absolutely right, Freddie. And I think, you know, maybe that is the simplest way for somebody today to start realizing I have been doing that, or I have to carve out more time. I have to allow to hold that thought. And why is it coming? And the question, why does it keep coming back to me?
Mm-hmm.
I think that is something that's you sharing that today. I think, you know, someone hearing that probably has experienced that before.
It's really interesting. And we spend a lot of time, we make appointments, we fill up our calendar to be on somebody else's schedule, but we rarely spend that time and make appointments with ourselves to spend even 15 minutes. We'll spend 30 minutes with someone, we'll spend an hour with someone, but you end up the day and you end up the week and you haven't spent meaningful time with yourself. And you mentioned it, that was my next point, do a technology fast. Turn off the phone. Even, you know, it's amazing, even if it's only 15 minutes of being divorced from your phone, your technology, your computer, your iPad, your Google Docs, and all the rest of it, it really forces you to be in touch with yourself. And then when you're in touch with yourself, my last idea is just to ask your intuition a question. Is this the right way? What is the best path for me? What will happen when I do this? And just let you just sit and wait for the answer. And the answer always comes. It's not a big like newspaper flashes or a big banner on a smartphone or what have you, but it comes and is really clear because, as I mentioned at the outset, you get that repetitive message over and over and over again.
See, that is very helpful. It was helpful for me 4 years ago when I was looking to take over a nonprofit, and I came to you, but only after a few weeks of thinking about this opportunity and reflecting upon that opportunity. And I think I came to you in a state of, my thought process was, this is going to be a good experience for me. This is going to be a challenge for me. And I remember sitting down with you in your office and you said, Joe, I think you've made your decision. I can just feel it that you've given enough thought to this. And here I am 4 years later, not regretting taking that opportunity and feeling proud that I accomplished things that even just 4 years ago, I didn't think I could. And so when you framed it that way, Freddie, I started to think about 4 years ago before I came to you. And you're right. I think I had made up my mind, but only after a couple weeks of really thinking about what am I going to gain from this? What's the best path for me? The best path for Joe McKenzie was to gain this valuable experience and to challenge myself with something new. And I have no regrets. So I just want to thank you. You were that one person.
Wow.
That I turned to. And I remember you, I was sitting down in your office and you just said, I think you've given it enough thought and I think your instincts are telling you the right direction.
Well, bravo, and thank you for that. Unexpected, but unfortunately, Joe, we have to leave it right there. Do you have a final thought?
I just want to thank you for giving me the book that has allowed me to refine some of the things that you helped me with a few years ago, but just something that I can use daily and then share it with the New Beginnings listeners, I think is important because we've all been there and we have to know how to trust our instincts. And how do we do that?
All right, Joe, you do some fine work at Ripple Connects.
Yes, we do. We turn candidates into contenders.
And this is New Beginnings. It's a pleasure to share with you each week on New Beginnings, and it happened this week. In 1894, as a matter of fact, the Montreal Hockey Club defeated the Ottawa Hockey Club 3-1 in the first Stanley Cup Championship. In 1934, the first Masters Golf Championship began in Augusta, Florida. In 1978, high wire artist Carl Wallenda fell to his death while attempting to walk a cable strung between two hotels in San Juan, Puerto Rico. He was 73 years old. In 1985, Wendy's Hamburger Restaurant ended its relationship with Clara Peller. She coined the famous phrase,
"Where's the beef?"
In 1990, former tanker captain Joseph Hazelwood was found innocent on three charges in connection to the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. The jury convicted him on a charge of negligent discharge of oil. In 1994, animator Walter Lantz died at the age of 93. You remember him. He created such popular cartoon characters such as Woody Woodpecker and the Panda and Chili Willy. In 1994, the National Football League announced the addition of the two-point conversion. It was the league's first scoring change in 75 years. In 2001, animator, producer William Hanna died at the age of 90. Hanna, along with Joseph Barbera, yeah, that team, comprised a cartoon-creating duo of Hanna-Barbera, whose work included the Tom and Jerry cartoons, Yogi Bear, and the Flintstones. And finally, in 2012, the Los Angeles County Coroner made the long-awaited announcement that the singer Whitney Houston died from an accidental drowning on February 11, 2012. The coroner also said heart disease and cocaine contributed to the music star's untimely death at the age of 48. It happened this week, and I'm Freddie Bell.
This is a news-oriented broadcast, and all information is educational in nature, is not intended to be legal, securities, tax, or insurance advice. Please consult with the appropriate professional before acting on information heard during the broadcast.
You're listening to New Beginnings. New Beginnings with Freddie Bell.
Hi, everyone. I'm Freddie Bell, and now it's time to talk finance with Libel Sternbach. Libel is an Amazon best-selling author of Living with Financial Anxiety and Authenticity. And Libel, we had a really energized conversation talking about the failure of the Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. I'm just wondering, for our listeners who don't already know, can you recap what happened with Silicon Valley Bank and where we are right now?
So with Silicon Valley Bank, they essentially had to write off some bad debt, which created a hole in their balance sheet. And regulations forced them to sell assets at a significant loss, even though these assets, if held to maturity, would have returned their principal plus profit. The government, the rules required that they sell those assets. They ended up selling it at a $2 billion loss in order to cover depositors, which then caused this whole run on the bank as people lost confidence and things spiraled out of control. And the state of California stepped in to take over the bank. Signature Bank, you know, completely kind of separate. We're still kind of unraveling what that is, but that seems to be related more to crypto than to your usual run on the bank type of situations. Either way, right, the big question that we have in our minds is what's happening to these banks something that can spread to the rest of the economy? Is it a symptom of what's happening in the economy and that's what's causing it? And these are, you know, kind of interesting questions that we really need to answer. Now, as retirees, right, I mean, I know that the biggest fear that I'm hearing right now is this the sign of things to come, right? Is this the smoke before the fire, or the fire that precedes the smoke? And that is really the question on people's minds. And so let's dive into what that is, right?
Okay.
When we look at Silicon Valley Bank, and you're going to hear for the next few weeks, right? It's going to be the only thing on the news, actually, probably until Wednesday when the Fed comes out and talks about what they're doing. And that's probably going to just add fuel to the fire. The question on everyone's mind is Silicon Valley Bank something that is the precursor of what's to come, or is it the symptom of what's already been happening and therefore it's a good thing? Right. And you're like, wait, how does the 16th largest bank failing be a good thing? Right. How could it possibly be a good thing? Well, this all kind of goes back to what's been happening in the market for the last, 18 months, really. there's this fight between the Federal Reserve, the Congress, and Wall Street. And they're all in this argument with each other. Of course, they're not talking to each other. They're just, you know, doing actions, you know, like a very dysfunctional family. And they just, each one has their belief about what's happening in the world and what, where it needs to be. And the Federal Reserve keeps saying, well, we're not there, right? We keep trying to, you know, tamp down economic growth because we have people who are hiring too many people and they're paying them excess wage because they can't find people to hire. And really, there's too much money in the economy. So we need to damp things down because inflation is running away. And the two things that we're responsible for is inflation and a healthy labor market. And right now, we don't have either of those things. All right. So that's problem number one. And the Federal Reserve keeps saying we're not there yet. So we're raising interest rates because that's the only thing we can do. The Congress is like, but you're killing working Americans. And we love giving away free money because that gets us votes. And we've got this war in Ukraine that we're fighting, and we're sending billions of dollars worth of equipment there. And we're fighting this proxy war with China, this political war with China. So we're going to keep pumping money into the system because we have to do that for political reasons. And Wall Street is like, look, Federal Reserve, look at all these companies that keep firing people. Look at, you know, all these things that are happening in the economy. Really, the economy isn't as good as you think it is. And we're really experiencing that recession. So you don't have to keep raising interest rates. We want our free money back. And they're kind of keep pointing the finger at each other, saying that, you know, your version of reality isn't true, right? And we're not there yet. The question is Silicon Valley Bank, right? It is a major bank, 16th largest bank in the US before it collapsed. It collapsed, right? Is it the signs of a stressed labor market, of a stressed economy, of the first signs of cooling, right? The first major signs of cooling beyond, you know, these major corporations laying off employees? Or is it the, you know, just the beginning, right? Is it just the precursor of we're about to enter into a great recession or a economic depression, right? And these banks are just falling apart. And that is, I mean, to some extent, it's unknowable. But if we look at just the data, right, I think that what happened with Silicon Valley Bank, I think part of it is a symptom of what's happening in the tech sector. We know the tech sector got overheated, right? I don't think anyone has any doubt about that, that during COVID, during the last 2.5 years, there's been more money pumped into tech than there should have been, right? And the tech companies grew and they took on way too much debt. And they're doing things that just, you know, in some cases don't make sense. So the fact that the tech sector is experiencing, you know, kind of a correction, and the fact that it took down a bank along with it, you know, it's sad that it took down a bank, but that is part of the reality of having a correction in that sector. Will it affect the rest of the economy, right? I think to some extent it will, right? There's no getting around that. It will to some extent affect the rest of the economy. The Federal Reserve has stepped in and they've said, no, we're gonna make sure that nobody's affected by this. But here's the thing, right? Even if the depositors at Silicon Valley Bank can access all their money today, right, which is what the Federal Reserve said is going to be, even if everyone was made whole, it still leaves a scar on everyone's psyche, right? And when it really comes down to it, our economy is really, it's really about people's impressions of what the future is. Right. Everyone, it's a house of cards based on this perception of reality. And if people perceive that there's instability in the system, then it doesn't matter whether there's instability in the system. It now has instability. Exactly. People will start behaving differently. And this might give the Federal Reserve exactly what they wanted. Right. They wanted the labor market to cool down. They wanted more people to be unemployed so that there's a larger labor pool so that wages come down, which will bring inflation down. They want people to stop spending money so that there are more goods than there are dollars chasing it, which will bring the cost of goods down. They wanted those things to happen. Yeah.
It just seems so counterintuitive that the federal government wants more people out of work. It just doesn't seem like it makes any sense, Label.
So it seems like it doesn't make sense, right? Because, and this is where the difference between the political needs and the economic needs, right? And the financial needs are different, right? Politically, we want every single person to be employed, right? That is, politically, it sounds right. It feels right. We want everyone to be employed. But the reality is if every person who wanted a job had a job, then I can't start a business, right? I can't open up a business and say, I want to do something new. I need 10 people who can create widgets for me, right? Because I'll never be able to find those 10 people to create widgets because they're all employed, right? So there needs to be a certain amount of people who are not employed, right? Who are looking for jobs so that new businesses could come around and hire them. And the question is how do you come up to this, you know, balancing act of how many people should be employed versus how many people should be unemployed so that the economy as a whole grows, right? So that we all prosper. And you don't want it to be the same people who are unemployed for an extended period of time. Because if it's the same people who are unemployed for an extended period of time, then they become hopeless and they stop looking for a job, right? So we want it to be that you're looking for a job for a few months, you find a job and you're good, right? And then, you know, maybe someone else quits their job or someone else gets fired because they weren't good at it, so they can now find another job.
So since all this is emotionally driven and it, you know, the perception becomes the reality, as you've always told us, so what does it really mean for the markets now? What does it mean for retirement savings? What does it mean for us, even as we go into the next election cycle within the next couple of years or so?
So I think what it means, there are two directions that we can take as a country, right, as an economy. Direction number one is we can get really scared and people can start hoarding their cash and they can stop hiring people and the economy can cool, right? Now, the question is going to be, how much does it cool, right? Is it just for like a month or two? Or does this become like, you know, another 18 months or another 2 or 3 years? Right. I don't know if you remember the great recession. It was supposed to be a short recovery. We pumped, you know, billions of dollars back into the economy. I think it was actually like over $1 trillion we pumped back into the economy to try to boost it up. But people had gotten so scarred from what happened and the money couldn't flow to where it needed to go that it took a long time for us to recover. The question is are we going to do that to ourselves? Are we going to, because we're psychologically scarred from these banks failing and, you know, where people will lose jobs as a result of this. The question is are we going to, you know, get scarred from that and stop hiring people, or are we going to continue, right? And we're going to pick up ourselves up from our, you know, bootstraps and we're going to, you know, say, you know what, the worst is behind us and we're going to recover. And, you know, in 6 to 12 months, we'll look back and we'll be like, oh, that was, you know, that was the COVID recovery. That was the COVID hiccup, right? And either one is plausible. Mm-hmm. Here's the good news that I will give you, right? Okay. Regardless of what we think psychologically, right? Whatever, however people react, there's certain fundamentals. There's certain economic fundamentals that are at work that I think haven't registered in the data that the Fed is looking at. It hasn't registered in kind of all the conversations that people are having. Like even Wall Street hasn't really fully incorporated this into their models. And that is the fact that as a result of COVID and as a result of this Ukraine war, Western nations are bringing manufacturing back home, right? The Biden administration, they have been shutting down China's access to building, to manufacturing of high-tech equipment. We're incentivizing made in America, right? All kinds of incentives to bring it back. And we're not the only country doing that. COVID highlighted a real problem, a real national security crisis with having distributed manufacturing. So we're bringing manufacturing back home. I believe that's part of the reason why the labor market is still so heated up, because there are new businesses that are being opened up that are looking for high-tech employees. They're looking for really a full range of employees. And it isn't yet registering in all of the metrics that we look at, partially because a lot of these businesses are subsidized by the federal government, by national security budgets. And as a result, right, I think that that's going to give us a lift in whatever happens, right? So whether or not we get scared, our country is spending money, right? We're sending billions of dollars of equipment to Ukraine. We're investing in high-tech manufacturing at home. That's going to happen regardless of whether I'm scared to spend money or not, right? Mm. And the people who can work in these factories to build, you know, high-end chips for, you know, cruise missiles and for, you know, drones, that requires degrees. That requires, that's high-tech jobs, right? People who are getting paid, you know, high six-figure salaries. And that's money that's staying here that before was going overseas.
Interesting. We got to leave it right there. I know that Label Sternbach has an article about the Silicon Valley bank failure, and you can access that by going to yieldsforyou.com. That's yields, the number four, the letter U, yieldsforyou.com, and get more information about this Silicon Valley and also the impact that it could have on retirees. Join us again next time when we talk about the single biggest thing that retirees can do to protect themselves from market volatility. I promise you, you don't want to miss this one. I'm Freddie Bell, and more New Beginnings is straight ahead. And here are today's words to the wise. Life is about learning. Today's words to the wise, life is about learning. And to learn more, you can visit me at freddiebell.com. We'll be right back.
In today's world, we really need words of encouragement. Introducing Words to the Wise by Freddie Bell. Let your mind be opened by the wisdom of thought. Let the inspiration of the words feed your mind, body, and spirit. Regardless of the issues you face each day, Words to the Wise by Freddie Bell can help you power through. Words to the Wise by Freddie Bell, a handy reference, available on Amazon, FreddieBell.com, and Barnes & Noble.
As New Beginnings continues, we now take you to the spirituality portion of our program, where we introduce the senior minister of Unity South Twin Cities, the Reverend James Stacy. We now join Reverend Stacy with a program already in progress.
Oh boy, do I want to follow that. Thanks for warming them up. Getting the joy to flow. Right here, right now. I particularly like that lyric because I find it very meaningful to think that each one of us is a melody that God is singing into life. Do you ever stop and think that? That you are truly, literally, God's song. God's song. That amazes me. That gets me going. That gets me here right now. And that's the theme of my lesson. We're speaking about the angel of joy today. And we only behold that angel. We only sense it. We only welcome it. We only receive it when we're present. When we're in the now moment. The now moment. I catch myself more frequently than I like to admit. Dwelling on my past. Oh. And well, there were some fun times. I talked about dancing in Unity Seminary with shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. There was good back there in the past. And other times, oh, whether it's this church, my individual life, oh, what's going to happen ahead? You know that old joke about what is that on the road? Ahead? No, ahead. That was, I know, that's an old one. But thinking about the future, and I'm not always holding great expectations or welcoming because I'm too busy worrying about what might be. what could happen? Will I be ready? Will I be capable? Many of you have joined me for my Monday and Tuesday class recently. I'm pleased to say that we have 39 people attending those classes. But we're doing them hybrid. We have people in other states joining us over the screen and some special technology. And Tyler showed me how to set it up. But when the evening came, I had to set it up by myself. And I worried about that. What's going to happen tonight? Am I going to be able to do it? Will I get it right? All that forward worry and that remembering the past can keep us, keep me, from, as Ram Dass said, be here now. Anybody remember Ram Dass? I got to hear him speak at UND Temple in Kansas City. And I was just amazed. Sanctuary seated 1,300. And that wasn't enough for the crowd. The aisles, the stairs, everything filled in that room to almost a dangerous capacity. And he reminded us, as I will attempt to in my own way, to be here now, to be present to one another. I had a conversation this very morning before the service with some wisdom teachers I know. And we were talking about, well, what is the purpose of my life at this point? And we were reflecting. It sounds simplistic. Oh, that's just too easy. But perhaps our purpose, most essentially, is to be present and to be present to one another. To be present to one another. I'm going to challenge myself this week, and so I'm going to invite you into the challenge too. Keep a little journal, a piece of paper in the car, on your bedside table, by your TV, wherever you want to. But just try to notice and make little notes to yourself on that paper. I won't be seeing it. I won't be grading it. It's just for you. But keep a few notes when you notice yourself dwelling on the past or worrying about the future. In other words, not being here now. Just as we were singing with T. Michael and Judy a moment ago, that energy and the joy, yeah, you might remember it a few minutes later now, but you really felt it in the moment when it was happening. So this angel of joy, which we are greeting on this fourth Sunday in Lent, is something that is captured in the moment, is greeted in the moment. Joy is now, not yesterday, not in the future, but now. My lessons during this time of Lent are based on the book Our Better Angels by Jonathan Reckford. He is the CEO of Habitat for Humanity. And I'm getting so inspired that with the help of someone, I hope that we might invest some of our time in this coming year in a Habitat for Humanity project. They're really quite amazing. They've been conducted all over the world. But he wrote this book, Our Better Angels, or if you prefer, Our Inner Virtues. God-given. But we must use them. We must put them to work. An architect can think about the house to be constructed, But what would we have without those willing hands that go out and do the work? That do the work. It's not enough to think about it. You have to demonstrate it. Our Unity co-founders, Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, love that phrase. Demonstrate the truth you know. Demonstrate your understanding of life, about relationships, about work, about creativity, by practicing it, by doing it. Again, you may say, what a simple idea, Reverend Stacy.
You just heard a message coming from the Reverend James Stacy, the senior minister of Unity South in the Twin Cities. More information is found at their website at unitysouth.org. April 1st is normally called April Fool's Day, and I'm calling it April Fool's Weekend. You know, the 1st has long been a day when practical jokes and tricks are played on the unaware. It's a time when children convince their parents they've broken a bone. Parents get in on the planning, too. Classic April Fool jokes include caramel-covered onions or fake doggy doo-doo in inconvenient places. Businesses launch impractical or unbelievable products for the fun of the day, and newspapers print incredible headlines catching readers off guard. Of course, the trick to a good April Fool's prank is planning, and you also need to be the first to pull it off. There's no point in pursuing your prank if someone else beats you to it. Once the foolery has been triggered, everyone else will be on high alert, and the element of surprise will be lost. Some practical jokers go to great lengths to pull off their ruse. The more people involved, the greater the risk of being discovered before your plan can be deployed. That's our show, and thanks to our special guests for stopping by and sharing information that we hope can change lives. If you missed any of today's show, you can subscribe to our podcast or just Google Freddie Bell or stop by my website of the same name. Thanks for listening, and remember that each day is a chance for a new beginning. See you next week.